Hello again, everybody. This is Like a Rose, and welcome back to the None of the Above show, a show for everything non-mainstream. Tonight, as our special guest, I have Dr. Eric Sprankle, and I will let him introduce himself in just a second. And I wanted to update everyone. I am still not sure if we'll be staying at the 7 p.m. time slot, but if you want to follow the Twitter for the show, which is NONEOFABOVES, I always update that when there's any announcements. So, Dr. Sprankle, how are you doing today?
Not too bad, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. So, for anyone who's not familiar with your work, would you like to just introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure. I'm an associate professor of psychology at Minnesota State University in Mankato, Minnesota. I've been there, I think this is my seventh year now. I'm also a licensed clinical psychologist and certified sex therapist. I have a private practice that I do on the side in Minneapolis. My primary focus, pretty much my exclusive focus at this point, is anything related to sexual health. Research interests definitely focus in on sex work stigma and collaborating with sex workers' rights organizations to help them with any research projects that they want to undertake. And then just providing some outreach services to area clinics to train clinicians ranging from psychologists, social workers, and physicians on various issues relating to sexuality and sexual health.
Very cool. And that's very impressive. I actually find it really admirable that someone is so devoted to areas of sexual health, because that's something that our society can frequently look at in kind of a gimmicky fashion. Mm-hmm. So it's always refreshing to find someone, and I hate to, point out stereotypes, but to find someone who is cisgender male, who is doing this kind of work and doing it sincerely. So that is actually something that's really cool and I really respect.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I thought, because there was in the news recently about the Stormy Daniels story with Donald Trump, mm-hmm. I thought the public perception of sex work surrounding that might be a very interesting topic to discuss. What have your thoughts been surrounding that?
Just a few. I know people have been kind of launching into this on a couple of different sides that I'm seeing, that one trying to tone down, kind of like that this is a huge scandal that Trump allegedly had sex with, Stormy Daniels and paid some hush money. And that's becoming like a huge scandal, and trying to tone down that compared to everything else he's done, that shouldn't even be on our radar at all. But then even those who support like sex workers and sex workers' rights argue, they like, hey, whatever gets this guy impeached, I'm going to support. And they like give examples of like it took tax evasion to take down like Al Capone. So like anything that could hurt him, that could potentially lead to an impeachment, would be a good thing. I definitely disagree with that tactic. I understand where it's coming from. But I disagree with it, because when you look at who's on deck, you have Mike Pence's fantasy of a theocracy just waiting to take over. And so I'm a little concerned about, if Trump goes down, yeah, we can celebrate, but then what's next? And what is next? Is that going to be more productive and more harmful than what we actually have now? Because if we want to get optimistic at all about the current state, it's that maybe Trump is so chaotic, so disorganized, that it's actually hurting GOP productivity. And that's my only silver lining with the chaos that's going on right now, and why I'm not calling for, or has never been really enthusiastic about, impeachment of him, especially related to Stormy Daniels. Because if all the racist, sexist, and imperialist things that Trump has done and said without any type of recourse for him, what do you think impeaching him over sex with a sex worker would do to sex work stigma? So I just think it reinforces this notion that that's like the worst thing a person, especially a public figure, can do. And I think that's just going to do a lot more harm than good.
Yeah, and that's where I was coming from when I tweeted that, you know, I think this is maybe going to be an issue because people are going to look at this a certain way. And one of the things I'm afraid of is, you know, everybody's going to be like, oh, big important person got caught, you know, using those words, having had sex with a sex worker of some type. And that's going to be an impetus to get Congress to pass legislation that will further restrict sex workers. And some of my friends have said they don't really foresee that happening as much, but I think the tendency to influence public perception, is already there from this.
Right, absolutely. I do not think sex positivity will come out on top of this becoming a big scandal for him.
Yeah, and it's really unfortunate that, Stormy Daniels is getting caught in the crossfire here as being someone who's effectively just doing her job. And if anyone's going to take an issue with something, it's, I think, should be with hush money getting paid to a sex worker. That's really the only thing that I see wrong with the whole situation. And then on, you know, one side, I'm kind of afraid to say too much on that front because if you do, people might think, oh, are you saying you're pro-Trump? Because he's, especially in trans circles, there's very few people that have a good opinion of him because of some of the things he's done since he came into office.
Yeah, and I understand that perspective too, and I certainly do not want to give Trump like any leeway for like anything that he has done, especially since taking office. But like what you were saying, that I think it's unfortunate that Stormy Daniels is put into the crosshairs of this scandal unnecessarily and unfairly, as well as just thinking that you know, just reinforces these notions of stigma that we have against sex in general and then sex workers specifically, that hush money even needs to be considered in cases like this, that if that information would get out, it would be a career ruiner. And I think we need to look at why we would consider this to be a career ruiner for people, regardless of political ideology. And I think that's where a lot of my concern is stemming from, is just this perpetuation of stigma and harm.
Right, and the fact that there's this purported hush money that was paid really affirms this sense that someone who is in the public eye feels the need to hide having sexual relations with a sex worker. And I guess that kind of brings me to one of the other things I wanted to chat about was social perception of sexuality, especially when it comes to sex work. And I know that's something that you've had a lot to say on Twitter. So one thing that I guess I'm kind of curious about is how you got to doing that sort of thing where you're speaking out on behalf of sex workers.
Sure. So the short story of it would be getting really interested in sexual health as a profession early on in my undergrad years. I think I was a second-year student or something. I took a college-level human sexuality class, and I was like, absolutely, this is what I want to do with my life. Whether that be, you know, full-time sex therapist as a clinician or sex researcher, advocate, something within sexual health. That's where I knew my passion rests. And this was like 2001, I think, 2002 maybe. And then so since then it was focused primarily more on just like the clinical aspects of it, what were things that were exposed to me in my like formal education, which is not that much, as you can imagine, in terms of being focused on sexuality. During my graduate school years, I believe that we spent out of 5 years of training, I believe an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours on sexuality. And that was
Wow.
just, yeah, I know. And that's probably more than a lot of people get.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and I see that, and that's why I'm really passionate about doing outreach kind of training for clinicians, if it's in the psychology field or the medical field, because I know they're just not getting that in their formal education, so they have to seek that out on their own elsewhere. And we see that too in the type of care that primary clinicians and general clinicians can give to people, and just that sexual health and sexuality is just overlooked, or at least in discomfort, or it's over-pathologized, all these things. So very little through my formal training was focused on that, so I had to seek it out through professional organizations. And then it wasn't until, 2012, when I met my current partner, Katie Bloomquist. She had a background, she has a master's in like sociology and social justice and responsibility. And she really focused in on the sex workers' rights movement. And she became involved in the Sex Workers Outreach Project and is currently their vice president. And it was,
wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, so it was throughout our relationship that I learned like pretty much everything about, you know, sex workers' rights, the sex worker rights movement, sex work as, you know, a labor industry, all these things, coming just into this topic area, just being supportive, but pretty not nuanced about it. Just be like, yeah, kind of the rhetoric that you see right now with people who are like supportive, but just kind of uneducated about it, like thinking that it should be legal as opposed to understanding decrim and that kind of stuff. So I was coming into it like, you know, pretty naive and pretty ignorant about it, but supportive on like that superficial level. And through our relationship together, Katie and myself, relationship, and then just, you know, connecting with other sex workers within like Minneapolis and then broader out in the Twin Cities, just really listening and understanding and kind of gathering that knowledge about all the nuance and seeing it from like a labor's rights perspective, you know, a Marxist perspective. And, you know, that just has really opened my eyes to everything, especially the, you know, the mistreatment and the unfair and violent laws that are imposed against sex workers. That's just been my work with Katie. That's been really kind of the springboard into advocacy and activism.
Wow, that's really cool. And it raised a couple questions when you were talking for me. One, we could briefly segue into the fact that you do offer seminars, and some of it's for clinicians. But I was kind of curious what all kind of audiences you do offer seminars for and what kind of things specifically they're about, if you just want to mention that real quick.
Sure. I've done a couple alone. It's really just kind of like how to conduct a sexual assessment 101. And then some more specific topics on like older adult sexuality. I've done topics on ethics within transgender healthcare. And the audience has ranged from clinical social workers to master's level therapists, doctoral level clinical psychologists, medical residents and physicians, marriage and family therapists. So broadly speaking, those in the medical profession as well as those in the mental health field. And then, you know, Katie and I will do the occasional talk with clinicians who are interested in increasing competency with working with sex workers as clients or patients. So we just started doing that, I would say, within the past year, and primarily to marriage and family therapists right now, since that's Katie's a marriage and family therapist. So we've been working more within her field.
Gotcha. So then my other question was, what has it been like to interact with sex workers in the Twin Cities area? I know you said that it was enlightening you for getting exposed to a lot of the things that your partner was working on, but I was curious what personal interactions in terms of like outreach and stuff, like how that's been for you.
Yeah, so the sex worker, the local chapter of the Sex Workers Outreach Project in Minneapolis is pretty new. So they're still trying to find kind of an overall mission and vision of kind of what they want to do at as a group and the kind of outreach that they want to provide and things like that. A lot of it up to this point, I would say like the past 2 years has more of just been kind of offering support spaces and safe spaces for sex workers to gather and, you know, reach out to one another and offer that kind of support that way. And then recently, I would say since this past summer, I've been working with them more on a formal level because they're conducting a needs assessment for workers within strip clubs in Minneapolis.
Right.
And I'm helping them design a study of how to do a needs assessment, you know, conducting, administering surveys, conducting interviews, that kind of stuff. And that's in response to some city council ordinances that are likely going to be written that aren't going to be friendly to workers in strip clubs. And this is all about concerns over trafficking, there's concerns about that strip clubs are just little hotbeds of HIV. So all these kind of myths and stereotypes about the sex industry just kind of being targeted at strip clubs right now in Minneapolis. And it doesn't help that we have the Super Bowl here in a couple of weeks. And so that's really been a backdrop to all of this, especially the trafficking stuff, because the myths surrounding the Super Bowl and trafficking. We've been trying to combat that for at least the past 18 months. So yeah, it's just been kind of on a personal note, just getting get to know some individuals working in the community has been great and personally fulfilling, and just making connections that way. And then also on a professional level, working with them as co-researchers has been certainly outside of the norm for academia in general, but definitely outside of the norm in academia and where I work. And so it's been nice and refreshing to be able to talk about that and at like, you know, just even like just department faculty meetings of like what kind of research I'm up to. And it's not just experimental based laboratory research. We're working out in the community as, with sex workers as co-researchers. They're leading the way. I'm just providing some material resources and support, as well as some guidance on some methodological issues. And so that's just been really, really refreshing, both personally and professionally.
Yeah, and I can imagine that that's exciting, because one of the things that I always really liked about being involved in academia when I was studying for my degree was just how the culture can be very inviting to the idea of experimenting with new ideas and looking mm-hmm. for information and wisdom in new places. So that is really exciting to hear mm-hmm. that is something you've been able to take into your professional work.
For sure. Yeah. And I'm going to be one of the first ones to criticize academia as a whole and what it does and what it doesn't do and how it's run more like a business, because it is a business in our capitalist system. And, you know, I can go on for hours about my critiques of academia and even my role as a professor. So it is nice to be able to try to break that bubble as best as I can, being on the inside, and to get a little bit more community-based and community-oriented.
Yeah, definitely. And you had mentioned, and I saw on your webpage, doing some research on older adult sexuality, and I was kind of curious what you had ended up doing in that research.
Sure. I haven't done it for a while. I still do talks on it occasionally because I teach one of the non-sexual health classes that I teach at MSU is psychology of aging. So I am still kind of focused on that area a little bit more on the side. But the last research project I did in that area, I think, was a study looking at staff members working within long-term care facilities and if they have any biases against same gender, similar gender, sexual behavior among residents at these facilities. And so it was an experimentally designed study in which we surveyed the staff members who worked in long-term care facilities. We gave them little vignettes about a scenario in which a care worker opened the door to one of the residents' room and discovered, you know, that resident was engaging in sexual behavior. And then we just manipulated the genders involved and the residents. And then we asked the participants, the staff members, if this fictitious staff member in this vignette responded in an appropriate way, just to see if there is some type of bias in there of how the staff member was responding to, you know, mixed gender versus same gender sexual behavior. And the results of that study were kind of mixed. We did see some bias. It was more dependent on the type of facility that staff member was working at, whether it was a public facility like a VA hospital or something similar to that, or a private religiously oriented facility. So we were seeing some significant differences across those lines, and lines that you would expect where the bias would show up a little bit more, like more in the religiously affiliated organizations.
And that makes sense. And it's a little bit unfortunate for older adults in assisted living facilities or the like. But that's kind of the world we live in.
Right, yeah. And that was the reason behind the research, is to see, like, experimentally, do we have evidence of bias? And if so, how and why? To develop better training programs for staff members to kind of challenge their own biases with working with LGBT older adults living in these residential facilities.
And I'm kind of curious, or I guess maybe that's not the right word, but kind of interested to hear, let me think of a way to phrase this, what you've learned about shame-based messages in society toward alternative sexuality over the years, not limited to just LGBT, but also older adult sexuality and, like, kink or fetishism.
So, if I'm hearing you correctly, just my views on shame-based messages that we receive that negatively impact us regarding sexuality?
Yeah, especially towards sexuality that doesn't fall within, you know, what people think of as young, straight, cisgendered, heteronormative couples that follow all the right rules.
Right, yeah. So what I usually talk about with this is that's the predominant narrative in our culture. It's shame-based around sexuality. For everyone. And then it just gets worse and worse for those that don't fit in to the prescribed, permitted type of sexual expression that gives some leeway to in our culture, which would be, heterosexual, married, purposes for procreation, pretty vanilla types of behavior, penile-vaginal intercourse, that kind of stuff, lights out, have a lot of guilt and shame afterwards. That's the ideal that we have in our culture. And as the further out that we deviate from that prescribed, socially acceptable kind of script, the more shame, the more negativity that we experience kind of further out on those margins. But it doesn't even have to be explicitly stated in our culture to have, like, shame-based messages, because the first thing that I talk about anytime I am giving a new training or in a new class on sexual health or sexuality, I just ask the class or the group, how many of you grew up in households in which sex could be openly talked about? If you had any questions, you could go to a parent or guardian and they would give you medically accurate information that's non-judgmental and value-free. And, a couple of hands maybe go up, and that's great. A few of us do grow up in households like that. And then I also asked the opposite of that question of, like, how many of you grew up in households in which you were explicitly told sex is bad, it's wrong, if you do it, you're going to hell, or whatever other kind of negative consequence that it has. And a couple of hands go up in those kind of fundamentalist households too. But then most individuals in these groups, whether, again, it's classroom or a training seminar, fall somewhere in the middle. And a good example of a middle is how many people grew up in households in which sex just wasn't talked about at all. It was like thing that you knew existed because, it's all around us, but in different ways, but it's just not being talked about. It's this big secret. And a lot of hands go up with that example. And I think that's just one example of messages that are indirect, that are still very shame-based and lead to a lot of taboos, myths, and misunderstandings about sexuality. And we get that, unfortunately, from day one of our lives. And it just compounds as we get older with the confusion and missed messages and the explicit shame-based messages that we get from some on the right. And so it just compounds. And to kind of go back to the initial question, my earlier point was that all exists. Even for those who exist within the tiny, tiny little bubble where sexuality can be socially permittable or permissible, rather. And then the further out that we get from that kind of socially sanctioned type of relationship and sexual behavior, the worse it gets in terms of shame and stigma, and then the type of impact that can have on us individually of just perpetuating guilt, shame, embarrassment about sexuality and how that's related to sexual dissatisfaction and sexual dysfunction, and placing us at greater risk of STIs because we're not informed and can't talk about it. So all these negative things.
Right. And I actually had an interesting experience where I was speaking with someone that I used to see for therapy early in my gender transition, just psychotherapy around gender and sexuality. And she was actually preparing to do some sort of education on safe sex and STIs. And I mentioned something that caught her off guard, and like she hadn't followed some of the research in the last decade or so on herpes virus as a contagion when there's not active virus shedding, and the rates of transmission for that being higher than previously thought. So that's like, it's something that even among clinicians, there's still a lack of information at times.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's definitely an unfortunate example of clinician incompetency and not even being aware of one's own incompetence and just kind of, you know, interacting with patients or clients in an authoritative kind of way of knowing or thinking and believing that, you know, we're the experts. We have the initials after our names. We have the, you know, the diplomas on our walls. We know what we're talking about. But we've been exposed to all these shame-based messages and misinformation about sexuality. So the physicians, the social workers, the psychologists, they're just as likely to share and perpetuate sex negativity and shame-based sex messages as like anybody else, because it's not being taught enough in higher education, especially within professional schools and graduate schools.
Yeah, and I liked how one of the things that you kept coming back to was the idea of this prescribed cultural narrative, and the farther you get away from that, the stronger the shame-based messages get. Right. Something that is kind of just starting to come to fruition is the idea that it's okay for transgender folk to have sex lives. It's like something that a couple decades ago would just be fully ridiculed in popular culture and media, but that's starting to come around. And one of the things I really try to do, in the fact that I post kinky stuff on Twitter as my internet persona, is try to encourage open sexual discussions that are trans-friendly. One of the reasons being that trans people are notoriously awkward about their own bodies and their own genitals, and my own personal discussions with other trans people have led me to the hypothesis that there are quite a few kinky trans people out there, and a lot of them are ashamed of that fact, because, you know, there's this trope that gets perpetuated that trans people are perverts. So trans people sometimes don't want to fall into that, and they don't want to talk about the things sexually for them that feel healthy and okay, will sometimes try to emulate sexual behaviors that they actually aren't as comfortable with, just because they think that those will be more widely accepted.
Yeah, I think that makes total sense of what you're saying. And you're absolutely right of how I think both the medical and psychological fields have ignored transgender sexuality. They viewed it historically as just focused just on transition health, and less so about satisfaction and pleasure and sexual functioning and all those things that you're mentioning. And I completely understand. I haven't thought about it in this way before, but I think it's really interesting, that perspective of the taboo surrounding kink or other forms of like alternative or unconventional kinds of sexual expression even being like self-pathologized in a way, because it's not being talked about as acceptable forms of sexual expression, but two, not wanting that additional stigma attached to them, that not only do they have you know, a gender identity that's stigmatized, but also now a type of sexual expression. So again, it's just kind of that compounding and that layered levels of shame-based messages and stigma that can have a cumulative effect on somebody.
And I'm kind of curious, since you're also looking at this from a clinician's perspective, what your thoughts are about the pathologizing of kink, especially with some of the changes and we've seen in the DSM over the years towards things like transgenderism.
Right. So in short, I think all of the consensual, unconventional sexual expressions, so they're just known as like paraphilias in the DSM, should be removed from the DSM. I know that with DSM-5 that came out in, I think, May 2013, there was a good distinction that was made. I mean, that was the addition that turned gender identity disorder into gender dysphoria and the importance of that language change.
Right.
And that's certainly important. But in terms of the paraphilias, they also had a slight language change and a distinction being made between what's a paraphilia and a paraphilic disorder, whereas the former is perfectly healthy. There's nothing wrong from a clinical perspective. It's just not practiced by the majority of the population, versus a paraphilic disorder in that it's having that kind of unconventional sexual arousal or interest or behavior that's also causing distress or interfering with their life in some way. So it's treating it no differently than any other diagnostic criteria for another mental disorder, is that you can have these feelings, you can have these behaviors, that's all fine. It's only problematic if it's personally distressing or interfering with their life in some way. So it makes sense, and I think that's a good language change. Why I still don't support the inclusion of some of the paraphilias, the consensual paraphilias listed in the DSM, is because, going back to my earlier points about the lack of training relating to sexuality, let alone training about paraphilias in graduate education and on internships and postdocs and things like that, unless you're specifically specializing in this area, that's going to get lost. That distinction is going to get lost, I would imagine, on just your generalist clinician, that they're going to see this paraphilia listed in the DSM and automatically impose their own biases and beliefs onto those interests and behaviors, regardless if it's distressing or interfering with the patient's life. And so the same with the public at large, that just because transvestic fetishism is listed in the DSM, even though you can only get diagnosed with that if it's, again, distressing or interfering with your life, the mere fact that it's just listed in this manual of mental disorders, I think, is doing more harm than good, especially since so few people actually meet criteria and diagnostic criteria for these paraphilic disorders, that removing them altogether, in my opinion, can help reduce some of the shame and stigma attached to these kink interests or behaviors or unconventional interests that are perfectly healthy, if it's not interfering with their life in a negative way, just like anything could in a negative way that we'd be concerned about. So just removing it can be like one step forward in not having people automatically assume that a paraphilia is pathological.
Right, and I think maybe moving away from listing specific paraphilias as possibly disorderly types could be something for that, especially when we live in an era with websites like WebMD.com, and you have frequent situations where parents will observe something in a teenager or overhear something and go diagnose their teenager with a paraphilic disorder.
Right. Absolutely. And that's been my clinical experience too. I don't do much clinical work now, but prior to starting in academia, I was a full-time clinician, and that was the only kind of quote-unquote paraphilic disorder that I would see clinically was those who were diagnosed by themselves because of Google and WebMD searches, or diagnosed by a family member or partner or loved one. And they actually didn't meet diagnostic criteria. There was actually nothing pathological about their interests. What was pathological was the amount of distress that they had about being aroused to something that is stigmatized.
Yeah, and that's actually something that I can say from personal experience, especially when I was younger and prior to transition, I was coprophilic and urolagnic, and I used to look at it as something that would qualify as a disorder. But I think most of that just came from the fact that especially trying to talk about those things, frequently people would react with, oh, that's something weird, that's gross, that's too kinky. And so I would be kind of left with a sense of, oh, well, there's something horribly wrong with me, when actually I was quite capable of normal sexual functioning and normal healthy relationships. It was just something that I also really liked. So I was definitely in that category of self-diagnosed in the past. And yeah, that's something that, you know, I worry about other people doing to themselves, which kind of brings me to what leads people into looking at sexual behavior as potentially compulsive and therefore possibly addictive or dangerous, which I know you have had some things to say about.
Yeah, so I think it's similar in that we over-pathologize things that do not fit into that tiny, tiny little bubble of socially sanctioned relationships and sexual behavior. And so then we start making judgments about, are you having sex too often? So too frequently. So it's just a numbers thing that if you have sex once a week with your spouse, that's fine. But if you're having sex daily, like, that's problematic, right? So we have these arbitrary ideas of like frequency and how that's healthy versus unhealthy. And none of it is actually any type of clinical reality, even though clinicians, many clinicians endorse frequency as a criterion to determine whether or not someone is quote unquote a sex addict. But I think it just falls into like everything that we've been talking about for this interview, is that things that make us uncomfortable about sexuality, either in ourselves or just seeing it in others, we're quick to pathologize it. And a lot of this, I would say most of it just comes from, you know, the cultural systems that keep us ignorant and ashamed of our sexuality. And then also just looking at it that on a personal level, because of that ignorance, we get a little egocentric or narcissistic about sexuality, right? And that whatever I'm doing is okay, but that other person, that's offensive, that's gross, so that must be unhealthy, right? So not making that distinction between that it's offensive or gross to me, but that doesn't automatically make it unhealthy or pathological. And same thing with like frequencies. Like if someone engages in sexual behavior, whatever that may be, 3 times a week, that's their normal, that's their idea of health. And if someone's engaging it 3 times a day, that's different from their own. So that must automatically be high frequency and compulsive in some way, just because we have a difficult time empathizing with other people's sexuality, sexual interests, and behavior. So like sex work, our discussion earlier, sex addiction, understanding sexual behavior, the rhetoric certainly lacks a lot of nuance and understanding.
Right. And not only do you tend to see the situation where people don't understand one another's sexuality, but you also see just as often situations where people are uncomfortable with their own sexual leanings and mm-hmm. will project that onto another person. And it reminds me of a Hermann Hesse quote, which it doesn't strictly fit, but I like to extrapolate the general meaning of the quote. And it's, if you hate a person, you hate something in him that is part of yourself. What mm-hmm. isn't part of ourselves doesn't disturb us. And I know that there have been a couple of really fascinating studies done on homophobia in people who actually have some homosexual leanings. And I know that there's more work that's been done, but I'm so far removed from any academia, and you know, my background was in engineering anyway, so I'm not familiar with a lot of it. But that's something that I just find absolutely fascinating, because that is something that you see, especially in the end, these some of the people who really advocate for sexual orientation being changed, you know, in camps and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then you come to find out later that person actually has had homoerotic leanings or a homosexual affair in the past. I just find it fascinating that that people project that kind of thing. And that happens just as much, I would think, as people failing to empathize with mm-hmm. another person's experience of sexuality.
Yeah, so I think, like, I see that occasionally pop up, even in, like, experimental research, that a study will confirm this, like, projection of internalized homophobia onto others. And I think it's really fascinating from the scientific perspective and very devastating from, you know, the real world perspective, that somebody can not only just have this internal cognitive dissonance between their feelings and their attitudes, but then behaviorally respond in a way that is very, very damaging and even violent to others. And when I see this come out, like in, like, sometimes, you know, news reports, you know, occasionally, like once a year, this story will pop up where, you know, some anti-gay politician or pastor or whomever comes out as gay, or more than likely is caught engaging in same-sex sexual behavior, and then, you know, they're easy comedic fodder for people of like, oh, they were doing, you know, advocating for these anti-gay policies and they were actually gay themselves, and this is just a projection, this was a projection for them this whole time. But I just see the whole thing as tragic, not only their behavioral response of them making other people's lives so miserable, but then the clinician empathy comes in too. And I empathize with their experience of like just how miserable they must have been their entire life and just tortured and tormented. There's no excuse of how they responded to that behaviorally, but it just is tragic all the way around.
Right. And very typically the case is that they were raised in environments where they were fed certain messages mm-hmm. and forced into certain types of thinking,
right.
where they very much grew to resent anything that they had internally. Mm-hmm. And to quote a perhaps inaccurate at times, but kind of interesting thing from, I want to say, Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal Lecter says to Clarice Starling, monsters are made, not born.
Right.
And I think that is very frequently true, that, you know, a lot of the people who do so much harm are actually very much hurting themselves because of their experiences.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tend to agree with, like, the, you know, the social influences of constructing our attitudes, especially towards sexuality. And it's, you know, we want easy things and people to point fingers at,
right.
That this is the culprit, you're to blame, you should be punished for this. And it's not that simple, but we want those simple answers. We want explanations in 140 characters instead of 140 books. We want simplicity. But unfortunately, nothing works that way. So when it's easy to kind of point fingers at like this one boogeyman for doing all this harm, we also have to kind of take a step back and understand the system that's been at play for their entire lives that kind of molded them in this way. And that doesn't excuse personal responsibility. It's just acknowledging that we just can't throw this one person under the bus and pat ourselves on the back thinking that we solved all these social issues, that we have to examine all of us and everybody that's perpetuating this harmful system.
Right, because calling one person out for things that they were doing or saying that ended up being harmful to others doesn't, I guess from an engineering perspective, you're failing to perform a root cause analysis is how I would see it.
Okay. Yeah. As a non-engineer, I have no idea what you just said, but I'll trust that that is a great analogy.
I've seen some of your tweets on topics like sex addiction. And I know that we had, mm-hmm. Started talking about that a few minutes ago, and I had actually, I am one day short of 3 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and at one point in my sobriety, I had actually, and a lot of this was driven by my own shame about just fetishism, but I had looked into groups that, 12-step programs that had this idea of sex addiction that they proclaim to treat, at least in some sense. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, I had some experience with learning a lot of things from that, but at the same time walking away with a sense of that they're really maybe not failing to address what the actual problem is by just saying, hey, these behaviors are compulsive and you shouldn't do them.
Right.
And I want to be fair to 12-step programs in the sense that the 12 steps kind of, you work towards this goal of an inner sense of balance and connection with your spiritual side that leads you from the need to engage in different types of compulsive behaviors. But there's still this sense that I got in those programs that just pointing a finger at sexual behaviors, labeling them as compulsive and bad, can end up being harmful in a lot of situations. So I was curious to hear what you thought about that.
Yeah, so I'm very interested in this debate about, is sex addiction real? Is it just another kind of moral panic, just over pathologizing anything that doesn't fit into that socially sanctioned little bubble, all these things. And just like sex work that we were talking about earlier, it's super complex. It's super nuanced to like start even like fully understanding where we can start like agreeing on most of these issues. And one being that I usually start this conversation of like, I think most individuals that we can agree that sexual behavior can be problematic for some. We can generally get universal support about that assertion that sex can be problematic for some people. So if that's not the controversy, then the controversy actually rests with, okay, if we can agree that sex can be problematic for some people, then the disagreement is really coming from understanding what causes it, how to assess it, what to call it, like diagnostically, like a diagnostic label, and then very importantly, how to treat it. And that's where you see a lot of this division. Where you have more of the sex addiction model camp that over-pathologizes healthy aspects of sexuality that just may be atypical or taboo.
Right.
So, for example, the sex addiction screening test, the SAST, coming out of like Patrick Carnes' model of sex addiction, that really goes into this division of what
causes problematic sexual behavior and how do we go about assessing it. So that's an assessment measure. And if you indicate that you've regularly engaged in BDSM or that you've bought sexual services or sold sexual services, or if you have multiple partners, things like that, that all ups your score on the sex addiction screening test, meaning that you're more likely to be a sex addict for engaging in these not inherently pathological things. And so that's where a lot of the disagreement comes from. And so I've worked with individuals who've had out of control sexual behavior to some degree. And another problem with this whole debate about is sex addiction real or not, is that we're treating all these individuals as like one homogenous group, thinking that their problematic sexual behavior is all stemming from the same thing. And that's not what data has said. That's not what my clinical experience has informed me about, that someone's problematic sexual behavior may be just a symptom of something else that's going on, whether that's diagnostic or not, like anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, things like that. It could be related to substance use. It may be just completely due to the person's relationship dynamics. And so we need to address it on a much individual level, as opposed to making just general assumptions as to what this is as like a cluster of symptoms, and then be very cautious of how we go about treating it to make sure that we're not shaming healthy expressions of sexuality and not blaming the sex act as being pathological, but how the person has engaged or has a relationship with that particular sex act.
Right. And, you know, from my personal experience, the idea of abstaining from certain behaviors can be kind of hit or miss in terms of mm-hmm. how helpful it is.
Right.
And if you're trying to assess someone based on, you know, some criteria of symptomology, and you're looking at BDSM, for example, as being likely to be more indicative of sexually addictive behavior, mm-hmm. then, you know, it ignores things where some people, for example, utilize aspects of kink in forms of pagan spirituality, or mm-hmm. You know, even as an adjunct to psychotherapy, which I know mm-hmm. is kind of a little bit off the deep end from, you know, most people's perspective, but mm-hmm. You know, when you fail to examine where things come from, or you try to group things together like that, it really does fail to take a nuanced perspective to a lot of this.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of going like full circle here for this interview of that's just perpetuating the shame-based messages about sexuality. We're automatically thinking that certain behaviors are inherently pathological and therefore that they have to be abstained in order to be a sexually healthy individual. That's certainly doing more harm than good, especially on a social and cultural level beyond just the individual.
Right. And we have you know, a fair number of religious groups who utilize, you know, very typically things like Old Testament verses to support the idea that certain behaviors or certain types of relationships, as they see it, are just inherently bad.
Mm-hmm.
And failing to look at sexuality as kind of a diverse thing that can be driven from many parts of a person's psyche and expressed in a great many ways, and instead seeing it as almost a catalog of behaviors that are simply good or bad, mm-hmm. which is overly reductionist and really, you know, it makes something that is very kind of abstract and wide into this too simplistic and too discrete way of trying to categorize things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's also prescriptive, like we've been talking about, too. Like Old and New Testaments, they have an idea of what is healthy sexuality and what is unhealthy sexuality. And there's a lot of reasons why those norms came to be in those two books. But nonetheless, it's prescriptive. It's somebody else telling you that this is the only way to be a sexually healthy individual. And that just completely ignores everything that we know now in the 21st century about sexual health. And that is on a very individual level. What's healthy for one person is not necessarily healthy for the other. We need to figure out what our sexual interests are, what arouses us, and how we can engage in that in a healthy manner. And that's going to be very, very individually specific and nothing that can be prescribed by someone else, let alone prescribed to an entire culture via religious text.
Right, absolutely. We're coming up on the end of the hour here, so I just wanted to ask if you had any closing thoughts for our audience.
No, just piggyback just only on what I just said, just because it's fresh in my mind of, make your own definition of sexual health. I'm going to give like parting words of wisdom. It's just that. It's find out who you are as a person, what you like, what turns you on, and then find out how to engage in those behaviors in the healthiest way possible. And that's going to look different for everybody. And that's just an individual journey that people have to go on.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I want to express my gratitude that you're able to do this.
No, my pleasure. And definitely thank you for the invitation. I appreciate that a lot.
Absolutely. So thank you everyone for tuning in. Again, like I said, if you follow none of Above's on Twitter, I will be posting if we move to a different time slot. Dr. Sprenkel has a website and he is on Twitter as well. Both of those are just DR SPRANKLE for the Twitter handle and ad.com for the website. Dr. Sprenkel, did you have any other resources you wanted to point anyone toward?
No, I mean, not off the top of my head. I mean, that's it for me. Good resources for sexual health would be like Mayo Clinic's website, things coming out of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University, Go Ask Alice out of Columbia University. Those are some good, just like pretty accessible online sources for general sex ed stuff.
Awesome. Well, thank you again so much for joining us. And I will be back next week at 7 p.m. Eastern on Slings Flings Radio, sfdradio.com. All of our shows are archived. I think it's on noneoftheabovespodbean.com. And that link should be on my Twitter as well. Again, this is Lyka Rose. My Safe for Work Twitter handle is TSLYCHA. And my nudes are at LykaXO, LYCHAXO. Have a good night, everyone. I'll see you again next week.